Okay, we are back for another episode of Spirit of the Game with Lewis Harry.
And then mate.
I think I'm going to be driving this train today for our March podcast. So we came up with an interesting topic as we kind of lead into the season and get some people thinking about the rules of golf. Our topic today is the most commonly broken rules of golf. I think as we approach tournament season and people start getting back on the golf course, hopefully soon here in Denver with a little bit of snow on the ground, but hopefully, as we get back on the golf course here soon and the season tournament season opens and posting begins, we can think about those rules that we may bend or break from time to time.
Yeah, I years ago wrote a series of articles on this topic for the Denver Post, the 10 most violated rules of golf. And it'll be interesting to see how your list compares to the one I came up with back in the day. But
So we do have 10. We do have 10 here today.
Okay, you're going to go from 10 to 1? Or are they just 10? Is there like the most violated versus the...
I don't think they're in any particular order. Okay. I think actually, if you look at all 10, I think they're probably violated equally amongst all the golf courses around the world.
We should have a list of the 10 knowingly violated rules where, you know, how many of these rules are violated on purpose, i.e. cheating?
I think some of this could probably play into that. Yeah. But we'll start with 10 and go down to 1 just on this list. But again, in no particular order because I think they're all violated to varying degrees of extent.
Okay. Bring it on.
But the first one on our list, number 10, is ground under repair.
Okay.
I think people have a certain idea in their head of what is or what isn't ground under repair. A common one that I see, especially in our tournaments, is a tire track or a rut from a maintenance vehicle. And, you know, it might be muddy or the ground might be soft and a golf car leaves a tire track in the fairway and people automatically go to their head, oh, that should be ground under repair.
Mm-hmm.
Or they see some sort of, you know, a patch of winter kill in the rough or just an area that, you know, maybe less favorable of a lie than another area of the golf course. They automatically think, oh, ground under repair. This should be ground under repair.
Yeah.
I think people fail to realize is ground under repair has a very specific definition under the rules of golf. There are things that meet the definition of ground under repair by default. There are things that the committee can define as ground under repair, but just because someone sees something on the fairway or the rough or on like a part of the golf course, it might not always be ground under repair like they think it is.
Yeah. My reaction to that one is first reaction I have is Jack Nicklaus, who famously many years ago made the statement, while commentating after playing his final round in the US Open. This is when he was kind of at the twilight of his career. They bring him up, you know, for the GOAT to talk about how the round went. Mm-hmm. And he made the comment, I think this was at Pinehurst in 1999, when Payne Stewart drove it into the, I may getting my years mixed up, but he said divots should be ground under repair. And there was a lot of support for that. There still is. There's a lot of people who believe. And when the rules were modernized in 2019, the number one comment from golfers on a rule they would like to see changed, it was that. We got to give you free relief. A divot in the fairway should be ground under repair. And as much as those of us who disagree, make the case that when is a divot a divot? Every lie you don't like in the fairway, all of a sudden the player is going to make a claim that they're in a divot or ground under repair. So it would be untenable to go down that road. But so that's the first reaction I have. And it also brings in the how to properly play a second ball when you think you might be in ground under repair and you're not sure how to proceed. Doubt is to procedure is whatever we call that now. So I agree with that's a good one for sure on this list.
Yeah. And if anyone knows me or is listening to me espouse my opinions on this podcast in the past, they'll know that I am a staunch opposer of relief from divots.
No, me too. 100%. It's not golf. It's no longer golf. It's like, you know, play the balls at lies, of course, as you find it, except there are already too many exceptions to it. And let's be honest, the PGA Tour is the worst role model because they play preferred lies all the time. So,
we could make an entire podcast episode just on this topic, but I mean, the basis of it is it's the nature of an outdoor sport.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you might think that someone's getting an advantage because they're playing earlier in the day and there's fewer divots on the golf course than when someone else plays, but hitting the fairway isn't a guarantee of a perfect lie.
That's right.
Just like being in the rough isn't guarantee of a bad lie.
Exactly.
So ball bounces both ways. And part of that skill is being able to navigate those lies and get your ball from point A to point B.
Exactly.
So,
all right, what's next?
That's all we'll say on that topic.
Okay.
Number nine is an incorrectly substituted ball. And the most famous or the pinnacle of this situation is someone having a special putting ball that they keep in their pocket for when they reach the putting green. Maybe they play a ball made for distance once they tee off. And then once they get to the green, they play a ball that has a little more feel and they can roll it better. Unfortunately, under the rules of golf, doing that is incorrectly substituting a golf ball. Fortunately, in 2023, the penalty for doing that, or penalty for making a stroke at that golf ball, has been reduced. It used to be the general penalty prior to this year, but now it's only one stroke.
Hey, it's probably worth it now. You know, you weigh that against, hey, I putt so much better with my putting ball, it's worth a one stroke penalty.
So if you, if you think that one stroke penalty is, you know, somehow negated by the advantage of that special putting ball, then be my guess. You know, prior to 2023, you know, with it being the general penalty, if you were playing a match and that happened, well, it didn't matter what that special putting ball could do for you. You just lost the hole.
Yep.
Now in both forms of play, it's a one stroke penalty, both stroke and match play.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt it. It's interesting. When I made the comment, it may be worth it. This is really a philosophical, truism in the rules, in my opinion. If you knowingly violate a rule, so you say the penalty is worth it, then that's really that's so egregious, so against the spirit of golf, where you've kind of done the math and said, I know this is a penalty, but I'm going to go ahead and do it because it's worth it. I mean, that's really, and where does that, what does that bring up in your mind? Who famously, supposedly, and this is another one we could do a whole episode on, anybody come to mind?
Well, the one I'm thinking of is Phil Mickelson.
Of course.
Putting on the putting green.
He supposedly made a calculation and said, in that moment in time when he watched his ball race by the hole at Shinnecock, he decided that he was going to strategically take the two strokes to play a moving ball, knowingly violate a rule, but it would be worth it, as if he thinks that quickly. And to me, and I'll have to get this off my chest, but we'll save some powder for another day. He should have been disqualified. Oh my goodness, did the USGA wiggle off? I mean, that was the most, when you knowingly violate a rule, that's called cheating. And the fact that the USGA sort of legislated their way out of that by finding, they just didn't want to have the added embarrassment. I don't know what they were thinking, but oh, that gets my blood boiling. Sorry.
Yeah, well, not to go down that wormhole, but that was also during a time where there was a decision that allowed the committee to waive a disqualification penalty in favor of the general penalty. So that was another loophole that's now been closed. Unfortunately, now the committee has to apply the penalties the way they're written.
So I guess
I would venture to guess Phil Mickelson would probably be disqualified today for that.
Yeah. Well, if that's the case, then that's a good change. But again, overarching statement, if you knowingly violate a rule, it's like the 14 club rule. If you knowingly, hey, I got that 15th club in my bag, but I've already paid the price, so I'm going to knowingly and continue to play with it, you're disqualified. Mm-hmm. I assume the same is still true today.
It is so, that actually
and that, did that make your list, the 14 club rule?
It did not. Okay. But that's true. 11, actually please. Did happen on the PGA Tour about 2 months ago. There was a player, and I can't remember what player it was. I guess it didn't matter.
Yeah.
There wasn't a notable player, but there was a player who had 15 clubs in the bag and knew that he breached that rule, failed to take that club out of the bag, and then teed off on another hole. I think that in that situation, this player knew he was missing the cut. Maybe wanted to get a few more reps with that 15th club before he went home.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you know,
he's disqualified.
Just got disqualified.
Good.
For that situation.
All right.
That did happen a few months ago.
Okay. What's next? That was number eight. Number
that was
seven.
Nine. So that we're on eight now. Okay. So eight is just the entire procedure around dropping, placing, and replacing.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, in people's minds, they think they know how to drop. They think they know how to put a ball back on a spot, but it gets done so wrong so many times. Mm-hmm. And even administering a tournament, helping a player take relief, there's been so many times where they either dropped in a wrong way, dropped in a wrong place, mm-hmm. or just didn't know anything about the whole procedure. Mm-hmm. You almost have to hold their hand and walk them through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a fundamental part of the rules. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why Rule 14 is the longest rule.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a fundamental part of rules because it overarches into Rules 16, Rules 17, mm-hmm. Rules 18, Rules 19.
Mm-hmm.
And it interweaves itself throughout the entire rules. It's mind-blowing to me how many people get it wrong.
Well, everything from the simple knee height, not getting that right, either crouching, holding your hand too high or too low. I mean, that's an example. You know, recently on the PGA Tour, when Max Homa was taking the lead from an embedded ball, our very own Pete Liss was helping him drop, 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 redrop in place. And that procedure of how he kept saying, just put it down like you're putting it on the putting green. Don't push it into the grass. You have to set it and then find a place where it will come, because it wasn't coming to rest in the location that where it hit the ground on the redrop. Mm-hmm. So that is so true. But in defense of golfers who get that wrong, it's subtle, but it's really kind of tricky. And I mean, you could say it's simple, but you get into that situation, a replacing of a ball, that doesn't remain at rest. That's not intuitive. It really isn't.
Yeah. You start getting into a situation where you drop again, and you place, but it's not going to stay on that spot. So now you get into drop, place, hunt,
exactly.
Place again.
And then it's closer to the hole. Is it not closer to the hole? No doubt that the procedures around, again, we've talked about it before. It'll be interesting to see if we evolve to a place where we don't drop the ball anymore and you place it all the time. It's still, you'd get people getting it wrong, but it would certainly simplify things.
It would. And just to wrap that up, that even on the putting green, when we're simply just replacing a ball,
mm-hmm.
even that I see done wrong from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
And what I see done wrong is mostly in casual rounds where, as we all know, the rules go out the window for the most part. But I see so many times where, you know, someone, they're trying to replace a ball in the green, they'll just toss it out of their pocket onto the ground and use their putter head to roll it over to their mark and put it there and then putt it from there.
Well, the one that we saw famously was Lexi Thompson. And again, was that purposeful or not, open to debate? But I even didn't know I was violating that rule for many years, where I thought, as long as my ball is touching the circumference of the coin, so to speak, I have a little fudge. So balls often come to rest in little depressions. That's why they came to rest there. So many times you'll see a player just nudge it. You won't see it necessarily, but you know they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Lexi Thompson was doing. She moved it about a half a ball. It was probably still, quote unquote, in contact with the coin, but it wasn't back on the spot. You have to put it back on the spot. Now, again, the rules have evolved where I can now potentially repair that depression, whereas before it had to be a ball mark. You have now a lot more leeway. If it's just an imperfection on the green, you are allowed to improve it. But anyway, that's definitely one I think that's broken a lot.
I also think Lexi's issue there, and what a little bit has been solved since, but with the use of video and, you know, going back and mm-hmm. replaying that video, you know, that played a part in that whole ruling as well, with that video being reviewed. Of course, you know, there still is reasonable judgment in the rules, but that's probably the most famous of that incident for sure. Okay, so we'll move on from that one and go on to number six, which is everything around ball searching.
Mm-hmm.
Again, just like dropping, we think that it's this simple thing that people should get right, but there's so many things surrounding ball searching that people get wrong or just fail to do. And the biggest thing is they fail to stop searching after 3 minutes.
Well, they fail to start a stopwatch.
Well, that's,
how do you know it's been 3 minutes? I don't know.
That's awesome.
Do we all have built-in egg timers in our, I promise you, there's no way you know 3 minutes. And I think, frankly, most people would under, if they were, 3 minutes is a long time once you start searching. When I play competitive golf, call me crazy, I will start a stopwatch on my phone once the search begins, whether it's my ball, your ball, That's how you protect the field. That's how you maintain pace. Why? The whole idea of changing that from 5 minutes to 3 minutes was to improve on pace of play. If you don't time it, then you're not improving. The whole point of the change is gone.
Yeah, and I would add that, yeah, no one starts or stops stopwatch when they're out there on their Saturday morning round, or even in competitive golf. No. I don't see players stopping at a stopwatch. It's always the referee.
I was playing in the CJ senior match play, playing with Scott Sullivan, one of our best senior players, and I started a stopwatch, and he said, "Ed, I've never seen that before." I'm like, what? I didn't even he says I've never seen a player. It was my ball that we were looking for. And I've never seen a player time their search. And this is a guy who's played USGA championships, made it to the round of 16, maybe the quarterfinals in the US Senior Amateur, as a college coach. Never seen it. Unbelievable to me. So I don't know. It's almost like if you start a stopwatch, you're somehow, I don't know, it's just like rude. No.
You know, people also don't realize that 3 minutes is the mechanism from turning a ball from in play to being lost.
Mm-hmm.
And when a ball becomes lost, it becomes a wrong ball.
Mm-hmm.
And as we both know, playing a wrong ball comes with some serious consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I think people, the whole thing around searching for a ball, the 3 minutes, when a ball becomes lost, you know, mistakenly people declaring their ball lost when they just, you know, they give up on searching. Well, I just declare it lost. It's gone.
Right. So
maybe
this is a good segue. It may get us out of order here, but is one of our top 10 failure to go back to the tee?
We're going to get there at some point.
Okay. Well, let's just get there now.
Yeah. We'll jump ahead.
We'll jump to that one. I'm going to throw off your count because it's really pairs with what we just talked about. So the first thing I'll say about this one is on a crowded public golf course, nobody's going back to the tee when they lose a ball. Nobody. And if they do, they're going to be, you know, they're not going to be very popular. And frankly, they shouldn't be because that's ridiculous. And so my soapbox on this is definitely on the list of most violated rules. But use the model local rule. Estimate where the ball was lost. Go, you know, lost or out of bounds. And on an equidistant arc, bring it back to the fairway. Drop it in the fairway. What is it, within one club length of the... and proceed from there. Two-stroke penalty, and off you go. Best local rule by far that's available to the committee. I hope we start to see that rule being used because it preserves the outcome, which is it's a significant penalty. Two strokes effectively is like going back under stroke and distance, but it saves you all that time. Mm-hmm. So search for three, start a stopwatch, use the local rule, and everybody's happy.
A caveat to that, and I will say this because I think there are people who know the model local rule who probably use it but don't fully understand it.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who routinely hit provisional balls, once you hit that provisional ball, model local rule E5 is no longer available to you for mm-hmm. that original.
So why don't you explain the local rule? Just from A to Z.
So model local rule E5 was implemented during the 2019 rule change. It basically is what the title of it says it is. It's an alternative to a ball that's lost or out of bounds. It's an alternative to stroke and distance. So normally without the model local rule, your only option is to go back to where you last made a stroke from, stroke and distance. One stroke and then however you need to get that ball back in play, whether it's on the tee, dropping it, placing it. Wherever you last made that stroke from, getting it back in play and going from there. Model local rule in effect, it essentially allows you, and this is where I think people get a little bit tripped up with this, because they think it's the same as lateral relief from a penalty area or from an unplayable ball, but it's not exactly the same as just taking two club lengths and dropping. Because mm-hmm. if you take two club lengths and drop from the white stakes, there's a chance you might get the ball in the right place with the relief area, but there's a chance you might not.
Mm-hmm.
So what it essentially does is it allows you to take the point where that ball either was lost or you estimated it to be lost or it went out of bounds or across the boundary of the golf course. And from that point, you're going to draw a relief area that goes equidistant out to the nearest point in the fairway. And from the flag to that nearest point in the fairway and to where that ball was either lost or out of bounds, there's sort of a triangle-shaped relief area that goes back And it's a little bit, there's a really good diagram of it either online for the USGA, or if you have a rule book that has the local rules in it, check out that diagram if you don't know what I'm talking about. But based on that kind of triangle shaped relief area between those few points, you're going to drop a ball in that triangle shaped relief area. Mm-hmm. Most people, because that triangle shaped relief area includes the fairway, most people are probably going to drop in the fairway.
Right.
Because why would you drop in the rough if you have the option to drop in the fairway?
Yeah, there might be a better angle. There might be a light rough.
There might be.
But it's a very large area.
It's an extremely, it's the largest relief area in the books.
Right.
There's no relief area that's larger than what Model Local Relief side.
I just think it's a brilliant solution. I was on the committee, as I've said before, that we're struggling with this. All kinds of ideas were brought forward, and it was really at the 11th hour at the urging of Mike Davis, who was adamant that they'd be come up with some solution, because this is, I think, the number one most violated rule of golf before the local rule. So now we have a way to keep playing the game. And again, I think it's such a creative solution, because it still keeps the integrity and the severity of a lost ball and a ball that's out of bounds intact.
Well, and that's exactly, you just said it right there. It keeps the ability to move the game moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Because before, without the model local rule, there wasn't really a mechanism.
No, you're done.
For getting a ball back in play outside of stroke and distance.
I had more rounds of golf sort of just ended in my head, because I'd be playing and I get so mad. I'd be a really good round and I lose a ball on the 16th hole. And I couldn't go back to the tee because it's just completely impractical. So I'm like, okay, I'm done, disqualified. Because to me, it was very important that I play 18 holes according to the rules, hole out all my putts. I know we'll get to that. And then I considered it to be a legitimate round. And now I think with that model local rule, I can still feel I did that.
Yeah. It provides that mechanism for the player to have a ball counting in their score,
which is
probably the biggest piece of that whole thing. Okay, so we'll reel it back a little bit on our list here, but we'll go back. Number seven is touching, lifting, and rotating the ball. This kind of goes along with our dropping procedure with replacing and, you know, dropping and placing the ball, but touching, lifting, rotating, and it even ties in a little bit of ball searching when someone tries to identify a ball. I see a lot of times people just pick that ball up to identify and they don't mark it before they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they pick that ball up. Well, unfortunately, they weren't searching for it at the time, so going to get dinged that one stroke penalty when they do it. I think that the second part of that with the lifting, I see a lot of times people just rotating the ball to get a look at it when they're identifying it and they don't mark it. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, under the rules, rotating it, even on its spot, is treated as lifting the ball.
Right.
And I think people don't realize that just by rotating it by hand, even though it's not leaving the spot, it's treated as you either lift it or move that ball. I think that gets broken a lot.
I
think the rules have cleaned up a lot of the accidental touching or the accidental lifting or moving of the golf ball. For the most part, it's totally been cleaned up on the putting green. But there are times where I see people either touching their ball, accidentally lifting it, rotating it. They're doing so and breaching that rule.
Yeah, and one of the ways I helps me remember this is, and I'm not sure I'll get this exactly right, but that's why you're here to keep hold me accountable. When you are proceeding in the rules of golf and you are touching your ball in a situation where you're going to be required to put it back, you have to mark it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're lifting your ball off of a cart path to take relief, you don't have to mark it because the rules don't require you to put it back. So that's always a very helpful rule of thumb. So when your ball's in play and you're not sure if it's yours and you want to lift it, you better mark it. Your ball's in play and you think it might be embedded, you better mark it. So remember, because again, in those situations, you're going to have to put it back. Now, once you've determined that the relief you were seeking is not available to you, it's not embedded, it is available to you, that now you're fine. You can lift the mark. It's probably a pretty good idea to keep it there. But no, you're absolutely right. I think most people, when they see it all the time, and I just kind of cringe, ball's in the middle of the fairway, is that mine? They pick it up, look at it. Nope, and then they just sort of casually toss it back down there. And like, no. Yeah.
That it's, and it goes along the lines of the ones we've already talked about. It's, you know, as people who are in the rules, who are administering events to us, it seems almost like an elementary level of something. But for the average player, it's.
Well, and again, what does it speak to? Play the ball as it lies. That lie is sacred. Getting back to divots and fairways, you have to play it as it lies. So you don't pick it up. Get it. Keep your paws off the ball.
That's right. Okay. We're I'm pretty much halfway through our list here, so we'll keep knocking down these ones. But this one, and actually, if this list was in order of most broken, this would be at the top, in my opinion. But it's the nearest point of complete relief.
Yeah.
When we talk about nearest point of complete relief, we're talking about relief from an abnormal course condition. So taking relief off the cart path, taking relief from ground and repair, temporary water, an animal hole, any of those items.
And again, to interject, what do all those things have in common? No penalty.
Free relief.
Exactly.
It falls under the category of we're moving the ball away from our interference for free.
And the good news is the deal is, I'll tell you what, we're going to give you free relief, but you got to do it correctly. So people confuse, and I know you're going to get to it, nearest with nicest.
That is an important distinction, nearest versus nicest. And to get to that nearest point of complete relief, that there's a bit of a step-by-step process to do it. Now, we can avoid that process and just drop the ball. If you haven't seen it, we have a great CGA Rules of Golf video on skipping that process for the nearest point of complete relief. So
Technical Tom versus Casual Carl.
So if you haven't seen that, go check it out and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about here. But if we go through that process of nearest point of complete relief, there's one thing to keep in mind. There's only one point of nearest point of complete relief. Any situation we get in when we're taking relief from an ACC, there's only one nearest point of complete relief. We don't have what David
said. ACC, abnormal course condition. Okay, I got to translate for those that aren't as acronyms.
ACC, abnormal course condition. So
don't confuse that with the athletic conference, the college.
Yeah, the Atlantic Coast Conference. Yeah, yeah. We're not talking about the conference of Duke and North Carolina here. Okay. So, but that one point on your point of complete relief, like I said, there's only one. What David Saylor likes to call in the rules is choosies. We don't have a choosy when it comes to nearest point of complete relief. There's only one. And that's where it comes into this debate about nearest point versus nicest point.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, when they're taking relief from either cart path or temporary water, in their head, they automatically want to go to the nicest point of complete relief. Where's the point where it's going to give me the best lie or the best angle to the green or the clearest shot?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always the case. Sometimes it might be. Sometimes that nearest point of complete relief might just happen to coincide with the nicest point.
Right.
And the player might get lucky. But not always. And it's not a choice. So I see a lot of people just automatically wanting to default to that nicest point instead of the nearest.
Yeah, and you see a lot of personality. And I think the video we did really does a good job illustrating it, where people who are just kind of fast and loose with the rules, or at least don't have a tidy closet and their desk is a little bit disheveled and they're kind of sloppy. You know, it doesn't, again, the other thing I love about another analogy is show your work when you're doing a math equation. Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea. If you show your work, you're probably more likely to come to the correct outcome. So it's not required to go through all these steps and to put T's in the ground and measure. And a lot of times, I'd say more times than not, I'm trying to get my acronym right, the nearest point of complete relief, I was from an ACC, is obvious and is clear. And the one video we did with Casual Tom and or Casual Carl and Technical Tom is a great example. It was very obvious. Mm-hmm. And you don't need to be that meticulous. But you're absolutely right. There is a spot. But now, and the other thing about it, though, while there is a spot, that's sort of the pivot point for that club length. So even if you didn't absolutely pinpoint that location, doesn't mean automatically you're going to get it in the wrong spot. Just means you're less likely to get it in the wrong spot because you have a very clear point of reference. And if you don't do that, you're more likely that you could get it wrong. But you still have a pretty nice area.
There's a pretty big margin for error when we're dropping.
Yeah.
For that to club length. Yeah. So.
Exactly.
Still see it wrong time to time though.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Number four. And this kind of goes a little bit with, this came from your list. So I'll let you, kind of do the explanation on this one, but, and it crosses over a tiny bit with the rules of handicapping, but it's maxing out on a hole or picking up before, maybe like, you know, when we talk about handicapping, we have a max score we can reach or, you know, maybe we can't post higher than a certain score on a hole. And we just pick it up because that's good for my handicap.
So we'll avoid going deep into the handicapping rules, but with maximum score. But this is definitely how often is it where somebody just either picks up their ball, a little tap in, just scoops it up, misses a one footer, and everybody in the group says, "Oh, that was good." It happens all the time. So failure to hole out. And in my younger years, when I took the game a lot more seriously. I alluded to this earlier when I couldn't proceed under stroke and distance. I would always hole out. And if somebody gave me a putt, it would drive me crazy. I would just, you know, and you want to be polite. Your father-in-law gives you a putt and you're like, okay, what's more important, peace in my marriage or, you know, adhering to the exact details of the rules? But it just happens. In competition, that always cracks me up when I have had rulings in over the years in junior tournaments. Less, you know, players who aren't quite as experienced in tournaments, and you'll try to decipher a ruling, you know, and then they say, well, he never holed out. You're like, excuse me? Oh yeah, he scooped it up on number four, and we're talking about a ruling on number seven. I'm like, well, it's kind of a moot point because when you don't hole out on number four in a stroke play competition, you're kind of done. You got to get it in the hole. So
that's. Something that's been true for many, many years and still continues to be true to this day. If you fail to hole out and you don't correct that mistake, everything after that is irrelevant.
I'm laughing to myself thinking about not to plug a club pro guy. I'm not sure it's appropriate, but he talks about the rake back. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, conspiracy ways to fail to hole out. But,
you know, the whole, you know, that was good or, you know, don't max out on a hole. There's a little bit of a pet peeve with that for me. That's a good anecdotal here, but I was playing at Common Ground this summer. A significant other and I were playing. We got paired up with, two other people that we hadn't met prior. They were just happened to be on our same tee time, going down the first hole when, you know, we're just kind of doing our own thing. They're doing their own thing. We get to the green. I lag a putt up to the hole, comes out, you know, 2 or 3 feet short. And without saying anything or without ever having interacted with this person before, that person automatically just goes and smacks my ball back to me before I get up to it. And being a person like you who likes to hole out on every hole and who likes to keep a legitimate score by the rules, it somewhat irked me a little bit. And I was somewhat glad that we were only playing 9 holes that day. So.
What did you do? Did you put it back and hole out?
No, I went on to 2. So okay. I guess, you know, I also failed to hole out that day. So
there you go.
Smack me on the wrist for that one. But
no, I'm with you. I'm with you.
It kind of caught me by surprise. So
it is amazing how challenging it is to make, I'll even say, a 2.5 footer with pressure. It's not easy. And when people tee up, and I always say there's golf, and I don't know who said it originally. It's not original to me. There's golf and there's tournament golf. And I think the hardest thing for unskilled or new players to competition is holing out those short ones because they're not easy. You miss a lot of them.
Yeah. I don't know who the quote's attributed to, but there's a quote that, you know, a 3-footer gets a lot harder the day the checks get handed out.
Yes.
someone probably back. No doubt.
Well, the problem with short putts, not to get too far off topic, you have an expectation you're going to make it. You don't really get nervous on the 8-footer or the 10-footer because, you make some, you miss. You're going to miss a lot of those. But when you get to 3, sure. Nobody's – and you're a little embarrassed when you miss a short one. So that adds to the stress for sure.
Absolutely does. All right. So that kind of – actually, that kind of took care of a couple off – one or two off our list with, you know, failing to hole out and also with, you know, maxing out for your handicap, whatever you want to call it. Getting down to the end of our list here is advice.
Mm-hmm. Is this our last one?
We have one more after
okay.
that.
Yeah, this was mine. It wasn't on your list, but advice. I mean, how often is it where your player says, offers advice? Again, the definition of advice, it's probably changed, but Is any counsel or suggestion which could influence a player in determining their play, choice of a club, method of making a stroke, information on rules or where the flag stick is located, public things is okay. So you really, you know, it gets very gray at times. If I say to you, boy, that wind picked up, you know, this could be a 2-club win today. You know, those sort of just sort of, innocuous comments, not a problem, but very common do you give advice during the course of a round and useful. Unfortunately, not only is there a penalty, but the advice is no good anyway.
Well, yeah, regardless if the advice works or not.
Yeah.
Rule 10 doesn't care.
Yeah. It's good advice or not. Yeah.
A breach is a breach of that rule, but
yeah.
I think there's a lot of people that think that some things are advice that they might not be under the definition. And there's some things that people think, just without thinking, they blurt it out, but it happens to be advice.
Can you give an example that comes to mind on both of those?
So something that I think some people think might be advice, you know, if you and I are playing in a group together, whether it's match play or stroke play, and I, you know, you're shooting, your rangefinder from 20 feet away, and I ask you, hey, what number did you get?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know,
here's another one.
Here, 170 yards is public information.
I have a better one. You and I are playing and we're on the seventh hole at Common Ground. And I say, what did you hit, by the way, back on 6? No problem. It's behind us.
Has no relevance.
Now, that could be kind of avoid the appearance of evil because you say, now I know when we get to the next par 3, maybe I'm going to use that information.
Sure.
But again, it's water under the bridge at that point.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly that. Something that has no relevance to the stroke being made or, like I said, the yardage to a certain location, the location of a penalty area or a bunker. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that under the definition of advice considered advice.
You're too young to remember, but it used to be the distance to the hole was considered advice. And if you asked for a distance, that was a violation. I think that's a good change.
That's something that's was a really good change. Something that's also been a change in 2023, which I think is really good. That has now included not under the definition of, or it's included in the definition of advice, but not being advice, is wind direction.
Hmm.
So if you ask which way the wind's blowing,
didn't know that.
And I know that the wind blows on number 11 at Common Ground from the west.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I tell you it's blowing from the west, it's no longer considered advice under the new definition.
That sort of, this is a different topic, but artificial devices, unusual equipment. I was playing at Denver Country Club. There was a caddy in the group. He carried dental floss and he held it up in the air to see which way the wind was blowing instead of tossing grass clippings. And at the time, I think that was a problem. I don't know if it still is. Holding up dental floss to see if the wind's blowing. It's almost like a windsock.
Yeah, it could be a problem. I know, at our section championship one year in Philadelphia, we had a player come up to me prior to the round and ask, had a clear, what looked like a ketchup bottle full of powder. And he was wondering if he could squeeze that bottle and a puff of powder comes out, then he could see which way the powder blows.
Okay.
And it's completely unusual. I had never seen that, but unfortunately, it's really not it really doesn't break the advice rule, but it breaks rule 4.3, which is other use of.
Yeah. So to give us an example, getting back to the topic of something that is advice that doesn't appear to be advice. It seems innocent. Can you think of one?
And this could go both ways actually, but, if you and I are setting on a par 3, and I hit a 5-iron.
Mm-hmm.
I come up short of the green.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I'm walking back to my bag, I throw my 5-iron back in my bag and I just blurt out, like, God, I should have hit a 4-iron.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an example of it could go both ways. If I'm just saying that in disgust with myself and I'm just, you know, talking to myself, muttering.
Right.
It might not be advice, but if I'm saying that with the purpose trying to influence you to hit a 4-iron or to you to also hit a 5-iron.
Mm-hmm.
That could start leaking over into advice, unintended advice, if that.
I think there are probably other situations where you're really doing something just to be a good neighbor, and you didn't mean anything by it. It was innocent.
I saw it all the time in junior golf where exactly that. Someone would say, well, if I was you,
yeah,
this is what I would do.
Yeah, and that's pretty black and white. Yeah. But again, as the saying goes, no good deed goes unpunished sometimes.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, the drum roll for the last one.
Well, again, this is no in particular order, so a little bit anticlimactic here, but the difference between red and yellow penalty areas.
Yeah.
You know, there's options you have for a yellow penalty area, which the fundamental option would be back on the line relief. There's options you have for a red penalty area, which the additional option there is lateral relief. And in seminars I've given and in tournaments I've administered, more often than not, I come across people who don't realize the difference between a yellow and a red penalty area. And even back before 2019, we were dealing with water hazards and lateral water hazards. And we had that fourth option for a red penalty area, which was equidistance on the other side of the penalty, or excuse me, on the other side of the water hazard at that point. It was even more muddying the waters and people not understanding the different options. So
probably the best sort of layman's simplistic way of thinking of it that I heard at a USGA seminar was lateral penalty areas catch stray shots, and penalty areas yellow, you have to, there's no way to finish the hole without crossing over them. So if you hit an errant shot, it's going to be red. If you hit a poor shot that didn't carry far enough, it's going to be yellow. That's a pretty good rule of thumb. Doesn't always apply. There's always exceptions. And again, you think about the way the rules are written around those, it makes sense because just it's a geometry game. The whole idea, I always talk about this, the original 13 rules written by the Honorable Company of Edinburgh Golfers back in 17 whatever, they said if your ball comes to rest in water or other watery filth or words to that effect, I always love that language, you would, basically what the rule said, you drop there and allow your opponent a stroke for the misfortune. So basically, the upshot of the original rule is it's not a stroke and distance penalty. It's not a lost ball. It's not an OB. So we're going to give you the benefit of the distance the ball traveled. So when you start to apply that in the field, if you said you just drop behind it, one stroke penalty, you can't do that when it's caught a stray shot. So you have to have this lateral, hence the word lateral. So it does, it's not a particularly difficult concept, but and again, I know in 2019, an effort was made to just say, why don't we make everything lateral? Let's just make everything lateral. Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds great, simple, you know, and it sounds great to make that overarching comment. But now let's talk about the 12th hole at Augusta National. If you made that a lateral penalty area, all of a sudden that shot doesn't become nearly as daunting because you're going to walk off of there with four a lot more often than five if we allowed you to drop on the green side. Because you probably, in most cases, think about Jordan Spieth, think about Greg Norman, famously, completely change that hole. So,
well, it changes the fundamental challenge of that hole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you talk about a yellow penalty area, something you have to navigate over to complete the hole.
Yep.
That it's really the, in keeping it yellow, that's keeping the architectural integrity of that hole.
That's right.
And I'm the last person to talk about architectural integrity, but I know an obstacle that you have to get over when I see it. There's ways with most red penalty areas, there's ways to play the hole without even ever encountering it.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of the times with the yellow penalty area, to complete that hole or to get to where you're going, you got to get over it.
That's right. So, well, I'll end this. My final comment, my final word on this topic is my favorite quote, maybe in not just in golf, but in life, because it applies to the way we live our everyday lives. There'll always be those eager to profit by the letter of the law to the detriment of the spirit. And I would much rather have somebody who breaks the rules routinely, but plays by the spirit of the game. And, you know, as opposed to somebody who, I always have taken issue with people who use their rules knowledge as a 15th club. And they are always looking for that C. Phil Mickelson. If that was true, that he was using his rules knowledge to quickly calculate his options in the heat of the moment, shame on him, instead of playing the ball as it was going to go. So that to me is more important. So if you play the ball as it lies and the course as you find it, as far as I'm concerned, I'll play golf with you anytime, any day. So Those are my final words.
Okay. Well said. I think it's a good point to, wrap it up there. So we'll figure out a new topic for the next one after this, and we'll be in the season by that point.
Sounds good.
All right.